Chapter 1. Meditations and Contemplations. Reading and conversation may furnish us with many ideas of men and things, yet it is our own meditation and the labor of our own thoughts that must form our judgment. Isaac Watts, The Improvement of the Mind. George Washington understood the power of books early in life. He started forming a personal library as a boy and added to it all his life. He treasured the books he owned, later commissioning an engraved armorial bookplate to paste into their covers. He often signed the title pages of his books, his autographs providing additional marks of ownership. The changes Washington's autograph underwent as he matured helped date several early acquisitions. According to the handwriting style of their title page inscriptions, some of the books that survive from Washington's library date from his adolescence. Other books he acquired in his late teens, when he deliberately changed his handwriting style. In adulthood, Washington's signature became fairly consistent, so it is more difficult to date subsequent acquisitions based solely on handwriting style. But the books Washington obtained in his youth provide a rich, yet largely untapped, resource for understanding his life, his mind, and his spirit. Washington's earliest known autograph survives on the title page of The Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation in General and of the Scripture Revelation in Particular, a set of sermons the Reverend Dr. Offspring Blackall presented as the Boyle Lectures in 1700. Washington's signature in this volume dates from around 1741, the year he turned 9. Though Washington was a precocious child as well as a pious one, Blackall's Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation does seem like a strange book for him to be reading as a boy. By no means was it standard reading for Anglicans in the 18th century. What was Washington doing with it? Before answering that question, some quick background detail about this book's oddly named author. Offspring Blackall came to prominence during a dispute with the Irish deist John Toland, whose appeal to reason in matters of faith attracted the vanguard of the Enlightenment and whose critique of arbitrary power foreshadowed the political thought of the American Revolution. Men of the cloth were less enthused with Toland's forward-thinking ideas. When he challenged some ancient Christian writings, and thus implicitly questioned the gospel, Blackall attacked. Toland counterattacked. Blackall emerged from the fray with a reputation for defending religion based on divine revelation, or more simply, revealed religion. Blackall accepted an invitation to deliver the Boyle Lectures in 1700. Though Robert Boyle had made a name for himself with his scientific experiments, think Boyle's Law, he was a profoundly devout man. As people questioned religious dogma in the face of modern scientific discovery, deism, which acknowledged the existence of God but followed no particular religion, posed a danger to Christianity. Sensing a threat, Boyle endowed a series of lectures to safeguard religious belief from scientific empiricism. His lecturers sought evidence to substantiate the tenets of Christianity. The Boyle lecturers did not convince everyone. Benjamin Franklin, for one, encountered some of their lectures when he was 15. Having begun to doubt divine revelation, Franklin avidly read the lectures. He had hoped they would quash his skepticism, but they had the opposite effect. Franklin famously explained, "The arguments of the deists, which were quoted to be refuted, appeared to me much stronger than the refutations. In short, I soon became a thorough deist." Franklin did not say which lectures he had read, but it is plausible that he read Blackall, who argued that the physical universe and the Holy Scriptures together provided sufficient evidence to affirm Christian belief. By the time Washington turned 15, the age Franklin was when he read the Boyle lectures, he could read, understand, and make up his own mind about what Blackall had to say. But what was a 9-year-old Virginia boy doing with a book filled with these heady ideas? Before he appreciated Blackhall's argument fully, Washington could put the book to other uses. Books have many purposes that transcend their texts. Autographing the title page of The Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation, Washington took possession of this volume, branding it as his own. Previously, Washington's Blackhall had been owned by Samuel Bowman and Robert Wycliffe, both of whom had signed their names in it multiple times. Readers leave lasting traces of themselves in their books. Though little else is known of Bowman and Wycliffe, their autographs in this surviving volume have saved them from total obscurity. On the verso of the title page, Wycliffe wrote his name, supplied some brief biographical detail, and dated his acquisition 1740. The information reveals that Wycliffe was around 12 when he took possession of The Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation. Blackhall's religious work contains little more to appeal to a 12-year-old than a 9-year-old. Yet books in general were valuable things in 18th-century Virginia. Perhaps Wycliffe built up the book in young Washington's eyes to gain an advantage in a trade. Regardless of how he obtained it, Washington took good care of Blackhall's book. Like many other Virginians who came of age in the middle third of the 18th century, Washington had great respect for the books in his possession, with good reason. In colonial America, a personal library was a hallmark of the proper gentleman. It allowed him to display his wealth, his cultural prestige, and his intellectual prowess to show guests in a subtle and sophisticated way who he was and what he thought. Washington's copy of Blackhall, bound in handsome yet unassuming tulle cheap, marks the earliest known beginnings of what would become his 18th-century gentleman's library. The survival of this volume demonstrates its importance to Washington. While giving away some other books from his personal collection, he kept his copy of The Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation all his life. Published in 1717, the year after Blackhall's death, the edition of The Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation Washington owned was poorly printed. The typographical errors in his copy are corrected by hand. Though it may be impossible to attribute these corrections to Washington definitively, they are consistent with typos he corrected in other books he owned. Washington's typographical corrections provide evidence of his meticulous nature and his penchant for accuracy. Discussing how to understand truth and use reason, Blackhall's flawed text mentions a right understand of the truths already delivered and a right use of reason in making inferences. Recognizing the word understand as a misprint for understanding, the keen-eyed reader placed an asterisk after understand and wrote in the corresponding margin, ing. In terms of handwriting style, these three letters are inconsistent with the same combination of letters in Washington's adolescent signature, but they are consistent with the ing in his teenage signature. Read in light of the handwritten corrections in other books he owned in his youth, the correction in Blackhall suggests that Washington read The Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation in his late teens. In other words, Washington realized the work was too much for him when he was a boy, but unlike Robert Wycliffe, he did not unload it. Even if he could not fully appreciate the book's text when he inscribed its title page in his boyhood, he apparently looked forward to the day he would. Understanding Blackhall took on the quality of an intellectual goal, something to strive for and achieve. Blackhall was one of many devotional authors Washington knew about in his youth. Several of the religious books in his library bear his youthful signature. His youthful attention to devotional literature is not unusual. Many boys and girls raised in the Anglican Church during the 18th century started reading religious books around the time of their first communion. Though Washington read much else during his formative years, from magazine verse to mathematical textbooks to stories of travel and adventure, devotional literature shaped the man he would become. Like many other religious books in his library, The Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation emphasizes meditation as a devotional practice. Blackall tells his readers, "What I would desire of you is that you would frequently think of those things which you profess to believe, that you would meditate much and often thereupon, that you would seriously consider the meaning thereof." The meditative practice, defined and delineated by Blackall and other religious authors, strongly influenced Washington's thought process. Their influence did not happen instantly. When Washington began his military career, a dangerous impetuosity guided his battlefield decisions. But slowly he came to understand how religious meditation could apply to realms outside religion. As military commander, legislator, and president, Washington would establish a reputation for long, slow, judicious reasoning. The decision-making process he demonstrated as an adult harkens back to the books he read in boyhood. Born February 22, 1732, according to the modern New Style calendar, which would not be officially adopted until 1752, George was the oldest son of Augustine and Mary Ball Washington. The two had wed on March 6, 1731. Mary was Augustine's second wife. Jane, his first wife, had died in 1729, leaving three children, Lawrence, Augustine, who went by Austin, and Jane. Augustine Washington sent both Lawrence and Austin to the Appleby School for their education. One of the finest schools in the north of England, Appleby offered students an excellent classical education. For generations, Washington boys had been educated at Appleby. Lawrence began attending in 1729, Austin 3 years later. Both became pupils of Richard Yates, whose tenure at Appleby would span six decades. By all accounts, the two brothers came away from Appleby well-educated and well-mannered. Both contributed to the library fund Yates had established for Appleby, which would help make its school library one of the finest in Britain. Lawrence returned to Virginia when he was around 20, and George was around 6. Lawrence would prove a powerful influence on his half-brother. The first of Mary's children, George was born at the family home in Virginia near Pope's Creek, a tributary of the Potomac River in Westmoreland County. Five more children would follow, four surviving into adulthood. John Augustine, or Jack, born in 1736, would be George's favorite sibling. George remembered Jack as the intimate companion of my youth and the most affectionate friend of my ripened age. In 1735, Augustine Washington moved his growing family to a plot of land on Little Hunting Creek, overlooking the Potomac. Lawrence would name this property Mount Vernon, after Admiral Edward Vernon, who led the British expedition against Cartagena, the Spanish colonial port on the northern tip of South America, in what is now Colombia, during the War of Jenkins's Ear. This Anglo-Spanish war is named for Robert Jenkins, an officer in the British Merchant Naval Service whose maiming rallied the English in the face of Spanish bravado. An officer during the Cartagena expedition, Lawrence had participated as one of the leaders of a daring nighttime amphibious assault. Once ashore, his troops attacked the battery, spiked the cannon, and repulsed the Spanish troops defending the coast. Admiral Vernon, who planned the assault, thoroughly impressed Lawrence Washington, who was proud to name his home after him. Leaving Lawrence at Mount Vernon in 1738, Augustine Washington relocated to a property on the Rappahannock River opposite Fredericksburg, the county seat. Their home became known as Ferry Farm, after the conveyance the Washington family operated across the river. Augustine Washington was an educated man. He, too, had attended Appleby School. Evidence of his reading is spotty. Only a few books from his personal library survive. One is a copy of the second edition of Henry Crouch's Complete View of the British Customs, the standard work on the subject, which people consulted as an official guide. Into his copy of Crouch's Customs he wrote, Augustine Washington, his book bought the 4th of May, 1737, of the bookseller under the Royal Exchange. Cost 7 shillings. This flyleaf inscription reflects the transatlantic voyage Augustine Washington made the year his son George turned 5. Motivated partly by business interests and partly by the desire to see how his older boys were doing at Appleby, Augustine accomplished this double goal before returning to Virginia. Crouch's Customs became a part of his permanent library at Ferry Farm. Its inscription reveals the personal attitude George's father took toward his library. He understood the importance of recording where and when he bought a new book. Inscribed with such details, a book becomes a physical artifact anchoring its owner to time and place. Augustine's inscription is fairly idiosyncratic. Rarely do 18th-century ownership inscriptions contain such precise detail. With it, Augustine turned the book's front flyleaf into a kind of receipt. His inscription also helped guard against theft, though it lacks the menacing playfulness of such traditional anti-theft flyleaf rhymes as, "Steal not this book for fear of life, for the owner carries a butcher knife." Augustine inscribed his name on 2 other pages in Crouch's Customs. Though these multiple autographs anticipate his son's double autograph in Blackhall's Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation, George's ownership inscriptions are nowhere near as specific as his father's inscription in Crouch's Customs. Rarely would George inscribe a book's title page with the year he bought it or the price he paid for it. Since so few volumes from Augustine Washington's library survive, his estate inventory offers the best indication of his literary tastes. Altogether, he owned a library of around 100 volumes. The size of his collection compares with those of many contemporary Virginia planters. The inventory lists 64 titles separately and groups the remaining in a single line, Sundry Old English and Latin Books. The library was predominantly belletristic in nature. Augustine owned The Spectator, the preeminent English periodical essay series written by Joseph Addison, Richard Steele, and a handful of other contributors. He also had a copy of Alexander Pope's translation of Homer's Iliad and a 6-volume set of Shakespeare. Augustine's religious collection was comparatively small. Besides a Bible and a Book of Common Prayer, the only other religious works listed are an abridged version of Gilbert Burnett's History of the Church of England and 8 volumes of the Reverend Dr. Samuel Clarke's 10-volume Sermons. Clarke's sermons may represent Augustine Washington's attitudes toward religion more fully than anything else. They develop the forward-thinking ideas Clarke had set forth in his Boyle lectures regarding the distinctions between natural and revealed religion. He thought that natural religion could be derived from reason. Clarke's ideas unwittingly supported the deistic argument that revealed religion was superfluous. It seems improbable that George Washington read these sermons in his adolescence, but his father could have distilled their contents for him as George approached his first communion. The controversy over revealed religion that Clarke fomented provides another possible clue to help understand what young Washington was doing with a copy of Blackall. He was growing curious about what revealed religion meant. The second week of April, 1743, George, now 11, was away from Ferry Farm visiting some nearby cousins when he learned that his father had been struck with a sudden illness. He rushed home as fast as he could. but he was too late. Before George returned home, Augustine Washington died on April 12, 1743. His death changed the direction of George's life significantly. Augustine Washington had intended to send him to Appleby as well, but now George's future was uncertain. Augustine's will made no provisions for George's education. After her husband's death, Mary Washington decided against sending her oldest son to Appleby. Perhaps she thought the family could not afford it, or perhaps she was afraid to expose George to smallpox, which adversely affected colonials who had little resistance to the disease. Maria Byrd, another Virginia widow, faced the same decision around the same time as Mary Washington. After the death of her husband, William Byrd II, she considered sending their son, William Byrd III, to England to complete his education. She even began planning the trip, but ultimately decided against it. As she wrote a friend, "I thought again he would certainly get the smallpox, which is most terrible fatal to those who are born in America, and that I should be accessory to his death." In George Washington's case, the simplest explanation is the best. Mary Washington wanted to keep her oldest son close to her. George inherited Ferry Farm, where his mother and her younger children remained for several years. As George passed from early adolescence into his late teens, he began spending more and more time with his older brother Lawrence at Mount Vernon. Regardless, his mother's influence on him remained profound. To use George Washington's own touching metaphor, she was the one who took him by the hand and led him from childhood. History has treated Mary Washington unevenly. 19th century biographer James Kirk Paulding, who interviewed people who had known her, practically canonized Mary Washington. In Paulding's words, she was high-spirited, yet of great simplicity of manners, uncommon strength of mind, and decision of character. Given that he dedicated his biography to all the mothers of the United States, Paulding could hardly say anything against Washington's mother. His portrayal of Mary Washington as a saint is fairly typical of the hagiographic George Washington biographies that appeared during the 19th century. Recent biographers have been more critical, using derogatory terms like harridan, harpy, and termagant to characterize George Washington's mother. No definitive evidence exists to pin down her character with any precision. The truth, no doubt, falls somewhere between saint and harpy. Those who are most critical of Mary Washington's personal behavior have extended their criticism to her intellect. One recent biographer says that she was illiterate. Much evidence exists to challenge this assertion. A grandson remembered her reading to him on Sunday evenings when he was a child. The boy would follow along as his grandmother read aloud from the family Bible. Listening to her, he gazed with childish wonder and admiration at the rude representations of saints and angels and the joys of the redeemed, and shuddered at the sights of the skeleton death and devils with horns and hoofs, holding in their claws pitchforks of fire. This grandson's experience sheds light on that of his Uncle George. The method that Mary Washington used to teach her grandchildren the Holy Scriptures, she developed while teaching her own children. Books containing evidence of Mary Washington's ownership reflect her piety and her personality. They also share a continuity with the devotional books in her son George's library. John Scott's Christian Life, an Anglican devotional manual she obtained 4 years before she married Augustine, stresses the importance of meditation for bringing people closer to God. Scott did not explain how the process of meditation worked, but another devotional author, the Reverend James Hervey, did. Mary Washington's copy of the two-volume edition of Hervey's Meditations and Contemplations reflects her attention to the work. She autographed it in four places, once on the back of each frontispiece and twice on the title page of the first volume. Hervey's Meditations and Contemplations was a renowned work that could be found throughout Virginia from the Chesapeake to the Blue Ridge. Planters and lawyers, burgesses and counselors, schoolteachers and parents, almost everyone, it seems, had Hervey in their homes. The number of copies does not fully indicate how widely read Hervey's Meditations was in colonial Virginia. People were so enthusiastic about its author's heartfelt sentiments that they shared their copies of Meditations with others. Mary Washington presumably shared hers with her son George. Meditations and Contemplations revitalized private devotional practice, giving readers examples of everyday subjects that could be used as the basis for personal devotion. Hervey's Meditations Among the Tombs conveyed the kind of melancholy that appealed to poetic souls. Explaining how to use a flower garden for personal reflection, Hervey said that the mind retains religious impressions more firmly when the instructive lessons are found not on the leaves of some formidable folio, but stand legible on the fine sarsnet of a narcissus, when they savor not of the lamp and recluse, but come breathing from the fragrant bosom of a jonquil. According to Hervey, people should practice their devotions outdoors. Mary Washington took his advice. Instead of always staying inside to practice her personal devotions, she often ventured outdoors to a secluded spot near Ferry Farm, a rocky ledge she used as a place for meditation. Hervey was not working in a vacuum, of course. His idea to use nature as a starting point for Christian devotion perpetuates the thought of earlier writers. Religious authors in the 17th century had emphasized the importance of what they called closet devotions. The phrase does not literally refer to a closet, but to a secluded place indoors for personal devotions. Typically, devout Christians would use the Holy Scriptures or some other religious text as a point of departure for their spiritual meditations. After reading a selected passage, they would ponder its meaning before ending their meditations in prayer. From the late 17th century, the potential subjects for meditation gradually expanded beyond the realm of the written word. In Occasional Reflections Upon Several Subjects, Robert Boyle suggested that everyday objects could form the basis for spiritual reflection. There is scarce anything that nature has made, or that men do or suffer, though the theme seem never so low and slight, whence the devout reflector cannot take an occasion of an aspiring meditation. Practically anything, Boyle implied, could function as a starting point for spiritual meditation. Jonathan Swift's Meditation on a Broomstick parodies the devotional tradition Boyle advocated. So does Benjamin Franklin's irreverent Meditation on a Quart Mug. To his credit, Boyle emphasized the use of natural objects for spiritual meditation, a method others subsequently developed. The approach pervades the work of Samuel Clarke and his fellow Boyle lecturers, who believe people could witness God's handiwork in nature. The most important literary precedent for Hervey's Meditations is John Ray's Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation, a book Hervey had read in college. George Washington read the book when he was college-aged or perhaps younger. According to the handwriting style of his title page autograph, he acquired his copy of Ray's Wisdom of God when he was in his teens. Best known as a scientist, John Ray applied his knowledge of the natural world to demonstrate not only the evidence of God, but also the evidence of God's goodness and wisdom. Part devotional manual and part natural history, the Wisdom of God presents a natural theology arguing that all aspects of nature, botany, geology, zoology, reveal the shaping hand of a benevolent deity. To the delight of the devout, Ray's account of nature jibes with orthodox interpretations of Holy Scripture. Since God created nature, Ray argued, people have the responsibility to contemplate it. We owe it to God to study creation. The study of natural history amounts to another form of devotion. If those with the ability, leisure, and opportunity to study nature refuse to do so, they detract from God's glory. Whereas Ray's work appealed to discriminating readers, Hervey had a much broader appeal. Looking back from the 19th century, British magazinist John Foster noted the powerful impact of Hervey's meditations, observing that no book contributed more to help people draw materials of devotional thought from the scenery of nature. Hervey helped take private devotions from the closet into the open air, giving Christian readers, like the Washingtons, an opportunity to commune with nature and bring themselves closer to God. Mary Washington also owned Eliza Haywood's Female Spectator, a four-volume set of periodical essays devoted to women's issues that could be found throughout colonial America. While providing numerous anecdotes to emphasize traditional feminine virtues, charity, chastity, modesty, Haywood also sought to expand the woman's sphere, emphasizing the importance of books for self-improvement. In one of her finest passages, she offers a paean to the educational and imaginative power of books. What clods of earth should we have been but for reading? How ignorant of everything but the spot we tread upon! Books are the channel through which all useful arts and sciences are conveyed. By the help of books we sit at ease and travel to the most distant parts, behold the customs and manners of all the different nations in the habitable globe, nay, take a view of heaven itself and traverse all the wonders of the skies. By books we learn to sustain calamity with patience and bear prosperity with moderation. By books we are enabled to compare past ages with the present, to discover what in our forefathers was worthy imitation and what should be avoided, to improve upon their virtues and take warning by their errors. It is books which dispel that gloomy melancholy our climate but too much inclines us to, and in its room diffuses an enlivening cheerfulness. In fine, we are indebted to books for everything that can profit or delight us. Since Mary Washington could not have acquired either Hervey's Meditations and Contemplations or The Female Spectator until George was in his late teens, these works did not significantly influence her instruction of him. Still, they suggest Mary's fondness for reading. Parents who read turn their children into readers. The example of Eliza Haywood illustrates this idea. George's library, like his mother's, reflects a curiosity about the writings of Eliza Haywood. The catalog he compiled in 1764, the year he turned 32, lists Haywood's Epistles for the Ladies. That same library catalog possesses a wealth of additional information about Washington's devotional reading. Since it retains the shelf organization of his Mount Vernon library, it shows what books he grouped together. Near his copy of Blackall's Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation, he kept Matthew Hale's Contemplations Moral and Divine, which, according to family tradition, Mary Washington read to her children as a basis for lessons in piety and wisdom. She later presented her personal copy to George, which remained a part of his library the rest of his life. In terms of its influence on her son, Hale's Contemplations was the most important volume on Mary Washington's bookshelf. Unlike so many other books from his library, George Washington's copy of Hale's Contemplations remained at Mount Vernon well into the 19th century. His family honored the work for its instructive value. Succeeding generations called the book A Counselor of Past Days. Comprised of short essays its author wrote as devotional exercises and first published in the late 17th century, Hale's contemplations appealed to Christian readers regardless of denomination. James Kirk Paulding, who borrowed Washington's copy of the book when he was writing his biography, thought it reflected his piety. Paulding found Hale's contemplations filled with lessons of virtue and wisdom, clothed in the simple language of sincerity and truth, and adorned in its hoary dignity like some ancient temple with rich vines bearing clusters of flowers and beautiful even in its decay. Another book from her personal library that Mary Washington passed along to George was Thomas Comer's Short Discourses Upon the Whole Common Prayer, a handsome volume bound in tooled and paneled calf with gilt edges. The book originally belonged to her husband, who inscribed his name on the front flyleaf, the title page, and the first page of the dedicatory epistle. The flyleaf inscription reads, August Washington, his book, 1727. As this inscription's date shows, Augustine acquired the work during his first marriage. Apparently, his second wife had a greater interest in literature than his first. Directly beneath the flyleaf inscription that identifies the book as his, she wrote, "And Mary Washington." A few years after her husband's death, his widow presented the volume to their son George, whose inscription suggests that mother and son shared possession of the book for a time. When he was about 13, George autographed it using large cursive letters adorned with several flourishes. Beneath his own name, he signed his mother's. On the back flyleaves, George inscribed his father's name several times. The ornate inscriptions show George taking possession of the volume. "This is my book," he seems to say. "I can do with it whatever I please." But these inscriptions also show him acknowledging his father's former ownership. William H. Bogart examined this copy of Comer many years ago, finding that it revealed much about George Washington's attitude toward his father. Bogart made the point that Washington's inscription revealed the deference and filial respect of his young years. Washington's surviving papers are silent when it comes to the subject of how he felt toward his father. These boyish inscriptions suggest that George experienced a great sense of loss after his father's death. Shelved in the library at Mount Vernon, George Washington's copy of Comber's Short Discourses became a symbol of his absent father. Like Hale's Contemplations, Comber's Short Discourses contributed to Washington's devotional meditation. Comber was best known for A Companion to the Temple and the Closet, an elaborate commentary on the Book of Common Prayer. He published Short Discourses as a more manageable approach to the same subject, the Liturgy of the Church of England, but it, too, is a fairly substantial volume. Short Discourses explains the Book of Common Prayer and celebrates its greatness. Besides detailing the sacramental uses of the Anglican Prayer Book, Comber explains how the Book of Common Prayer could be used in private, personal devotions. Comber's writing style, though somewhat peculiar, was clear and largely devoid of ornament. George Washington got the message. Like other devotional manuals on his bookshelf, Short Discourses emphasizes the personal and spiritual value of meditation. Comber intended Short Discourses to furnish the devout sons of the church with profitable meditations. The books Washington added to his personal library in his teens reinforced what he had learned in adolescence. Seneca's Morals has been widely acknowledged for shaping how Washington understood the relationship between virtue and happiness. It articulated a Stoic philosophy, emphasizing courage, emotional restraint, sacrifice, and tenacity. Previous commentators have identified Seneca as one of the few classical authors Washington read. But Seneca's morals influenced him partly because it echoed ideas he had previously encountered among Christian authors. In the dedicatory epistle of the edition Washington owned, translator Roger Lestrange stressed the continuity between Seneca's ethics and Christian belief, comparing Seneca's morals to the Holy Gospel and calling its author a good, honest Christian pagan who could serve as a moderator among pagan Christians. Seneca gave his readers much food for thought. Herman Melville would call Seneca's morals a round of beef where all hands may come and cut again. Speaking about Seneca elsewhere, Melville observes that a mere man and a heathen in that most heathenish time should give utterance to such heavenly wisdom seems more wonderful than that an inspired prophet should reveal it. As in many Christian devotional manuals, the word contemplation is central to Seneca's text. In chapter 8, the due contemplation of divine providence is the certain cure of all misfortunes. Seneca argues that by contemplating nature, people can attune themselves to the ways of God. Other Virginia readers recognized an affinity between Seneca's moral philosophy and Christian belief. Colonel William Fleming, an officer who served in the Virginia Regiment under Washington during the Seven Years' War, shelved his copy of Seneca's Morals with Hervey's Meditations and Ray's Wisdom of God. Seneca also offered a prescription for reading, which he closely linked to meditation. He advocated reading intensively, not extensively. In other words, it would be better to read a few books over and over again than to read one book after another without thoroughly digesting their contents. As you read, Seneca recommended, choose certain passages as a basis for meditation. Only by thinking can you truly understand what you read. Through the process of meditation, an author's ideas become our own and supply us with strength and virtue. A remarkable continuity runs through the books Washington encountered in his youth. Blackall, Comber, Hale, Hervey, Ray, Seneca. All these authors stress the importance of meditation. Other books from Washington's library offer additional examples. In Causes of the Decay of Christian Piety, Richard Alstrey, another English divine whose writings crossed denominational boundaries, used an organic metaphor to stress the value of meditation. When that spiritual seed lies loose and scattered upon the surface, and is not by deep and serious meditation harrowed, as it were, into the ground, it offers itself a ready prey to the devourer. Upon learning a particular technique, Washington had an uncanny ability to adjust and apply it in different situations. His meditative practice is no exception. As a boy, he learned to meditate as a way of practicing his piety. As an adult, he learned how to use his meditation to suit different circumstances. When faced with a conflict during wartime, controversy during his time as a legislator in the House of Burgesses and the Continental Congress, or contradictory views during his presidency, Washington applied his meditative powers to devise solutions to the difficulties he faced. After a battle had been won or a controversy resolved, he meditated further to help understand the meaning of his accomplishments. The most poignant example of his meditative practice comes from a diary entry he wrote the evening that the delegates to the Constitutional Convention finally approved the U.S. Constitution. After serving as president of the Constitutional Convention, Washington returned to his lodgings in Philadelphia, where he could meditate on the momentous work which had been executed. For George Washington, personal experiences became texts to be used for meditation, a process and practice that shaped his decisions on the battlefield and in the political arena.